I'm on. I'm on. That was the buildup, the whole buildup. I was waiting for, like, now, ladies and gentlemen, finally, News Dissector Radio Hour with Danny Schechter, the News Dissector, Polar Levine, the musician, and my basic running mate. I thought we'd introduce all that, but that was not to be. So we're here in the studio. We have a very packed show today. We're going to be talking about Syria and the war in Syria. We're going to be talking about the lawsuit against the New York Police Department and its treatment of Muslims here in New York City. We're going to be talking about Barack Obama's statement, you know, pronouncement that he's going to cut down on nuclear energy, nuclear weapons, which is a big question mark about whether or not he's really going to do it. So all of those are the topics that we're going to be getting into here. But first, I want to also introduce a guest in the studio, Zamila, who's here from Kazakhstan. I met her at the Eurasian Media Forum. She's come to New York. She's looking for a really good media internship, hint, hint, if anyone's listening. Welcome, Zamila. Say hello.
Hello.
Can you say hello in Kazakh?
Salam.
Can you say hello in Russian?
Здравствуйте.
There you go. She's a multilingual, multi-talented young student, and I met her in Kazakhstan. I was very impressed with her, and then she decided she wanted to come here and learn about our media, and here she is at Progressive Radio Network. So we're going to start off with a song that we'd like to share with you to set the tone for this program.
Stop it, bebop it.
Yeah, there it is. And that's a song about dropping the bomb. It's a song that is sung by
Charles Mingus.
None other than Charles Mingus.
None other than Charles Mingus.
And we wanted to start off that way also as a way of welcoming Alice Slater to the studio. Alice is somebody I've known for quite a long time. She's been active in the effort to stop nuclear testing, stop the use of nuclear weapons, to have real disarmament as opposed to phony disarmament. And I'm happy that she could come and join us, executive director of the New York-based Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy. So she has been very thoroughly immersed. No, you're not. You're not. You are without organizational affiliation now.
No, I'm with the
Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, the Abolition 2000 Coordinating Committee. See, I had the information here. So, Alice, just set the stage for us. We're waiting to see if we can reach Northern Ireland. Please let us know if we're able to do so. Tell us your experience now in terms of watching American politicians over the years decide they want to cut back on nuclear weapons and what's happened.
Well, that's the whole trouble. Cutting back on nuclear weapons, arms control, means they want to control the weapons. They don't want to give them up. And it's long past time to ban the bomb. There's a treaty in existence, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, where we promised in 1970 that we were going to get rid of our nuclear weapons if all the rest of the world promised not to get them. And there were five of us, the U.S., Russia, China, France, and England, and all the rest of the world signed on, except for India, Pakistan, and Israel, and they got the bomb. And now, here it is, 2013, and there are 19,000 weapons on the planet. And you have Barack Obama giving this huge speech yesterday in Germany that he wants to make nuclear arms reductions. And he's going to do this with Russia. And everybody knows Russia will not even talk to us because we're surrounding them with missiles. We're putting them in former Soviet republics. And the response to his speech from Russia was, we're not interested unless you're going to stop surrounding us with missiles and threatening us.
Well, you know, of course, when we discuss nuclear weapons, you know, technology has enabled the people who make nuclear weapons to MIRV them, to make weapons with increasing power. So you can reduce the absolute number of weapons, but not the detonation capacity that they have. In other words, the danger of nuclear weapons is still there.
We shouldn't even be talking about the technicalities because, look, two very crude bombs wiped out the entire city of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So all this improving that they're doing, I mean, a bomb is a bomb. I mean, the Physicians for International Physicians of Prevention Nuclear War just did a big study that you'd have global famine if 100 of these bombs were used. I mean, it's just, it's way past time to ban the bomb.
I'm trying to arrange to reach someone in Northern Ireland, and there are two numbers. You have one here. He has another one there. Could you try to see if he can have that number, and we can actually get this organized in advance? It would really make my day a lot better if we actually can communicate information, which we're trying to do. So thank you for your patience. And is she with us?
On hold.
Okay, so just quick, you know, Alice, there was a time when the Ban the Bomb movement in England, in America, Committee for Sane Nuclear Policy, all of that was something that, you know, people really cared deeply about. And now it's become more of the province of experts, of people debating the fine points, the minutiae of various agreements that most people really don't even know exist or what they mean. You know, so, you know, right now when we talk about nuclear weapons, we're you know, attacking the Iranians who don't have any nuclear weapons, but who may at some point have them. And so that is what's exercising us, or the North Koreans. But our own weapons, how many are there?
There are 19,000 on the planet, and 18,000 are in the U.S. and Russia. It's really up to us and Russia. And they won't talk to us unless we promise not to put missiles in former Soviet republics like Ukraine and Georgia, and we're surrounding them with missiles.
So they have a legitimate fears as well.
Absolutely.
Of being isolated, of being surrounded. And as a result, we're making very little progress. President Obama signaled an interest in doing something about it, but you say it's not going to amount to much.
I don't think so, because we're spending $184 billion over the next 10 years on three new bomb factories and new missiles, submarines, and planes to deliver them. I mean, who's kidding who?
So, you know, that has been the big war and peace issue that's been with us from the beginning of the Cold War, from the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But we've had, subsequent to that, regional conflicts, regional wars. And one of them, which has been a war in one country, seems to be spreading to others. Syria is perhaps the next battleground of engagement for the United States. A lot of people in the United States are concerned about that. Of course, a lot of people in the rest of the world are concerned about it. Myra McGuire was a nuclear, I don't want to elevate you to that, a Nobel Prize winner who is just back in Northern Ireland after leading a peace delegation to Syria. And thank you so much for joining us. It's a little confusing on our end, so please stay with us, but we have managed to reach Northern Ireland. And can you tell us a little bit about the trip you took there and what you saw?
Yes, indeed. I went with a delegation of 16 people from 8 countries, and we were invited by the Musalaha reconciliation movement from Syria and the Patriarch of Syria to go in to see for ourselves what was happening in that country. We started.
Could you stop there for 1 second? Okay, please stop for 1 second. You were invited by an organization that most Americans have never heard of. When we think of Syria, we think of two forces, the Assad government, the regime, as it's called in our press, and the, quote, rebels, whoever they may be. Some of them apparently al-Qaeda supporters, some of them perhaps not. But that's how the situation is painted in American media. Two sides, both, you know, and the one side, the rebels, represents some sort of democracy in the making, and the other side, Assad, is the dictator who is murdering people. Yet you're saying there's more to Syria than that. Please explain that to us, because I want you to make this point, because I don't think many people understand it.
Well, within Syria itself, there is a grassroots people's movement, which has groups all over Syria, and they are people both from Muslim backgrounds, from Christian backgrounds, from secular backgrounds. Syria is a secular country, and the people of Syria, their first love is the Syrian country. And they have been working now to try to have the situation solved through dialogue and through negotiation. And they bring together people from right across the different communities, and they go out to speak to people who have taken the gun and are trying to, through violence, bring about political change, and encouraging them to respond to the Syrian government's call for ceasefire and to begin to solve the problem themselves as the Syrian people. It's a very exciting movement. It's a movement worthy of support, and your listeners can check it out on the website. But when we, within this movement, also are religious leaders from both the Christian and the Muslim communities, and they are saying to the outside world, please, no outside intervention. We, the Syrian people, can solve this problem ourselves, but we do not want outside intervention, particularly military intervention, because that will destabilize and destroy Syria.
So, you know, what you're saying is really profound, I think, very important, very invisible for the most part in the daily discourse in the news here in the United States, as I'm sure you're aware. And the fact that there are people actually, peace movement, actually among Syrians trying to do something to change the situation there in a nonviolent way is something we've heard nothing about at all whatsoever. Zero, zip, nada. And, you know, your courage in going there and the group that you went with, I think, deserves a tremendous amount of respect and a hearing, which is why I was so pleased when you accepted my invitation to come on the program. We've actually met before, but I'm sure I remember you better than you remember me. At any rate, what did you observe as you traveled around Syria? I mean, I'm sure being in a war zone, having, you know, been lived in Northern Ireland, you know something about that. What was it like? What was the sense of being there like for you? Were you scared? Were you protected? How did you perceive it?
No, we went unprotected because, I mean, we believe passionately that guns brought into any situation makes it very difficult to begin to have dialogue, negotiation, and frightens people. And so we went from a Gandhian, a peace perspective. We're peace, we're for peace, pro-peace, and we support anyone who wants to solve the problem through dialogue and negotiation. Indeed, in 1976 in Northern Ireland, it was recognized we couldn't solve our problem through militarism or paramilitarism, but only through all-inclusive, unconditional dialogue. And we were very excited when we were inside Syria, and we met with people. We visited hospitals. We visited refugee camps. We met from people of the opposition who'd taken arms and were coming in to try to solve the problem without arms. We met with the governor of Syria, the prime minister, and seven of the ministers. We spoke at the parliament in Syria. We learned of the constitutional changes that are being brought in by the Syrian government, which, again, the West hears nothing about. And we were quick to realize that the best people to bring about peace are the Syrian people themselves. They have a right to self-determination. And the outside world should not be training soldiers and funding them and sending foreign fighters into Syria, which is what is happening. This is a proxy war that is happening inside Syria. It's not a civil war. It is a proxy war. We learned inside Syria, and this was confirmed by both the religious leaders and the political people and people on the ground, that there are over 50,000 jihadi fundamentalist fighters attached to Al-Qaeda, well-equipped, well-trained, who are terrorizing the people of Syria. And many people have fled from Syria because they have been attacked by these outside jihadi forces.
So what you're saying is, you know, essentially that what Assad has been talking about terrorism, attacking a sectarian, a non-sectarian Syrian state, a non-religious state, you know, has a basis in reality. Okay, I mean, immediately when we hear that in our media, it just says Assad claims blah 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 blah. Now, you're an independent person. You're not there to support any political figures in Syria. What? Tell us what you saw that gave you this strong sense that we're not getting the full story.
Well, I just give you two short stories, and I could give you very many more. When we were in Beirut, before we went into Damascus in Syria, we visited several refugee camps. And in one of the refugee camps, which is a Palestinian refugee camp in Beirut, and they were hosting 7,000 Syrian Palestinians who'd fled Syria to come into Beirut and arrived at the camp. And these Palestinian people and refugees in Beirut had practically nothing. I mean, because the influx of refugees fleeing Syria, going into Lebanon and surrounding countries, they just can't cope with the numbers. There's over 1 million had fled from Syria inside Syria, 4 million internally displaced. But I'll tell you one story. We said to one young man and his wife, he was an engineer, she was a chemist. They were standing in a refugee camp on a cement floor with not as much as a mattress, with nothing. And we said, well, why did you flee your home in Syria? And the man explained to us that they were from homes in Syria, that foreign fighters had come in, that these people were from other countries, Chechnya, Iraq, Germany, Europe, that they were shooting, killing, they raped women, and they were burning. And he and his wife and whole family all fled into Lebanon. And he said, these are foreign fighters in to destroy our country. Now, when we went into Damascus, we visited the hospital in Damascus, and the doctors explained to us and brought us around patients, and they said that these people have been shot, attacked by mostly foreign fighters, also some caught up with the armed opposition groups who are active in there. And, of course, the government itself is trying to stop this, and they are also using methods that should not be used. They're shelling areas. So it's a deeply complex situation. But one of the stories was, and Iman said to us, I spoke out against these foreigners, and he said they abducted me, and he said they tortured me for several days. They cut off my ear, they sliced my body, they tried to cut my throat, and they left me for dead. He said these are foreign fighters who've come into our country, who want to destroy our country, not to save Syria. They're fundamentalist extremists. They have their own agenda. He said they are not Muslims in the sense that Islam is a faith of peace. And so that his story was absolute confirmation that unfortunately inside Syria are foreign fighters. Now we asked, where are they being funded from? And we were told Qatar, Saudi Arabia, providing funds for these fighters inside Syria, that the American government is providing arms, and governments like the UK, America, France, they are supporting these armed fighters inside Syria.
It's
a very dangerous situation, because if this continues, then people in Syria, particularly the Christians and moderate Muslims, will flee Syria into surrounding countries and destabilize the Middle East. So it's a very dangerous situation
that we're
facing here.
There's just one question I wanted to ask you, if you have any knowledge of any of this. Of course, our president made a claim that the Syrian government has used chemical weapons, and 150 people have been exposed to chemical weapons, and he used that as the pretext for announcing that the United States is sending small arms, whatever that means.
And also, Danny, this is Alice Slater, the English and French actually got the European Union. You know, they went against the whole European Union, and they're selling arms. So it looks like the old white boys' colonial network again. I mean, you have the U.S., France, and England meddling. I mean, we're supporting UAE and Qatar, you know, that are Saudi Arabia. And it looks like it's almost like the old colonialism is rising up and causing trouble in this area that was always trouble before.
But did you hear anything about chemical weapons when you were there and your delegation was there?
Well, we had a 2-hour meeting with the Prime Minister in Syria, and we brought up the question. I myself asked the allegation that the Syrian government has used sarin gas. And he said to our delegation that as soon as news came from Aleppo that allegedly gas had been used, his government invited the UN to investigate immediately, because he said we did not use sarin gas or chemical weapons and would not use this against our own people. Now, the UN investigator, High Commissioner Carla DiPonto, she confirmed that the Syrian government had not used sarin gas, but that it had been used, and they didn't know if it was the rebels, but they had to get into Syria to properly investigate it. Now, I was in Geneva just 2 weeks ago with the UN High Commissioner and read out at that meeting to the UN in Geneva was a letter from the Grand Mufti saying, please come into our country, and this was supported by the Syrian government, come into Syria, do your investigations and see what's happening here on the ground, because we did not use gas. So this is another bit of war propaganda. I mean, I was in Iraq before the war started against Iraq. The crime, well, it was a crime against humanity, and the myth that Iraq had nuclear weapons. We knew there were no nuclear weapons in Iraq, and yet NATO went in and Western forces, and they practically destroyed Iraq.
It seems
they destroyed Libya, and now is the turn of Syria. So I think we have to stand up and say no to the destruction of Syria by outside forces.
Yeah. You know, I made a film called Weapons of Mass Deception. Okay, not of mass destruction, about the way the media sort of picks up unverified allegations and charges and takes it as if it's fact with no, you know, investigation on their parts, no effort to try to confirm claims. And as a consequence, people have an impression that something is happening, but they don't really have factual basis for it necessarily. But it's used as part of a way to win support for intervention, and that's what I think is so worrying, isn't it?
But Danny, I mean, as an anti-nuclear activist, we all knew that there were no nuclear weapons in Iraq. They had all been verified and checked during the first Gulf War over Papa Bush's war, and we knew they didn't have them. So it's not just that the media is being fed lies, it's that they don't listen to the people who know. I mean, they don't even want to get our point of view, and they're in bed with the government policy.
You know, what I'm curious about, Myred, the narrative that we've been getting here is that there were peaceful protests, and the protests were brutally put down by the Assad government. Now, we know that Assad's papa did some pretty nasty stuff when people were sweating him in the past. So it didn't seem to a cynic like myself when I hear about this stuff. It didn't seem, beyond possibility.
Far-fetched
that Junior would be doing the same thing. Now, is that narrative just completely wrong? This did not start with peaceful demonstrations that were put down by the government?
Well, let me tell you the narrative that we were given inside Syria by many people. First of all, 70% of the Syrian people support the president, and that's a statistic just released, believe it or not, by NATO. But even when we were inside Syria, people who supported their president, some did. Some people didn't support the president. Young people said to us, look, we don't support President Assad. We want changes, and his government is a regime too slow to change. But we are going to support President Assad until we get to the elections next year, because if we don't, there are outside forces coming in here, and our country could be destroyed.
Well, you know, Saddam Hussein got 99%.
That they were going to try to give peace a chance. Now, let me tell you what we were told with regard to the start. At the beginning, inside Syria, there was people coming out for change and asking the regime to change. It was a peaceful protest in the beginning, but tragically, guns appeared and violence started. And these were jihadists, well trained, and they started shooting at people and shooting at the soldiers, because in the initial process over 2.5 years ago, the Syrian army and police were not armed and were not shooting the people. It was coming from other sources, and when that began to happen, then eventually pressure was put on the Assad security forces to try to stop the violence that was taking place.
You know,
that is the story that we were given from inside the country.
Well, you know, I think it's important. I mean, I think your skepticism, Polar, is well, you know, placed, but the tendency, though, is to say, see, both sides are doing it, therefore, isn't that a shame, isn't that a tragedy, and not take a stand to try to come out for peace or to try to resolve and stop this. A lot of these incidents have not been fully investigated by outside bodies. There have been claims and counterclaims, but what we see is, I think, a pattern of these jihadi massacres that have been taking place, and then the reaction to it, and an escalation of violence, which, you know, how many 90,000 people are said to have died. I mean, this is very serious. I don't want to sound as if I'm supporting people who are killing other people. That's not my point. My point is that this whole conflict in Syria could blow up into a regional conflict from a national conflict and could spread. And I think a lot of people, including many people in our own military industrial sphere, in the Senate and others, are very fearful of getting involved, the United States getting involved more visibly in this conflict. Is that not true?
They might be fearful, but now we made a decision that we're going to send arms to them. I mean, the main thing is to try to stop the influx of the killing machine, you know, then they have a chance to negotiate. It's still on the table that there will be negotiations. So what do you think? How's that looking?
Well, I think that when we were in the mosque in Damascus at a huge celebration for peace, both the Grand Mufti and the Patriarch and all the religious leaders, they were all, their appeal was, please, to the outside world, do not send any guns or any outside militarism into our country. There are enough guns here. Give peace a chance. Peace and reconciliation is our message from the heart of Damascus. Lift the economic sanctions because they are hurting the people, and support the peace process. Groups like Musalaha and Peace and Reconciliation and Self-Determination of the Syrian people. And I think we have to listen to the Syrian voices. Now, unfortunately, there are outside forces who don't want peace. When we were there, Israel twice bombed Syria, and it was hardly even mentioned in the Western media at all. So we're dealing here with a situation where you have not only the local Syrian situation. It's a geopolitical thing here, but outside forces, NATO, America, France, Britain, they have to keep out of this and let the people of Syria have their peace process and solve the problem themselves.
Well, thank you. We have to break now, unfortunately. Do you want to make a quick comment? I'm sorry.
No.
I didn't mean to override you, as I tend to do from time to time, but it is 5:30. We are taking a break now. I just want to thank you so much for being willing to talk to us from your home in Northern Ireland and tell us about this visit that you took with a delegation into the war zone in Syria and discovered the presence of peace activists there who were trying to make a difference. And I think your voice deserves to be heard, and that's why I reached out to you. And thank you so much. You're listening to News Dissector Radio on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, PRN.FM. We're going to be back in a minute.
And they all did agree that the man who ran looked a lot like me. Well, the judge said, son, what's your alibi? If you're somewhere else, well, you don't.
Church of fear. The muezzins grin, the rabbis cheer. Yeah, I'll say it again, words in the book about that girl you're flogging and the land you're hogging. Very innocent, we'll foot the bill. Guilty are in speaking. The God of hate is the son of the man. Yes, and no cosmic plan. Hi.
That's a comment. We have with us, I believe, Deepa Kumar from New Jersey to join us in this next segment. I don't know if we've reached her or not. She's not there. Okay. We'll continue our conversation. I don't know what to do.
It
doesn't matter. We're in this room here. You were saying, Pilar, you were concerned that we might give the impression somehow that the Assad government is some sort of democratic progressive government.
I wish we had the time. I wanted to ask Mayred if just more about sort of a reality check against what we've been getting here. My understanding was that the Assad regime wasn't exactly benign over the past number of decades, and I know Saddam Hussein, who is also an elected official, got 99% of the vote of his people. So, you know, I was curious about that figure of 77% approval and how easy how easy it is for people to come forward and say, "Nah, the guy's an asshole," you know, over there in Syria.
But I think that after the war started, they were happier to have peace and quiet, you know, even if he was a lousy dictator, than to have 90,000 people killed in battle. So they're trying to, maybe they thought their best chance of stopping the war was with him.
Oh, yeah, that may be so. But, you know, in a timeline, and assuming, you know, Assad, you know, is the son of the father, you know, to break up a peaceful demonstration and have it lead to, you know, bombing cities, you know, my understanding is that it was the Assad's army that was up there in those planes dropping those bombs. You know, and the guys on the other side, whether they're jihadis or whatever, I don't think they were the guys dropping the bombs from the sky. Was it a response that was proportional, or was it another time when a despot says, "I don't want to be sweated by these people"? Kapow! You know.
Well, you know, we just had this incredible situation in Turkey. Okay, where a so-called reformist leader, moderate, etc., you know, sicked the police on peaceful protesters and seems to have alienated everyone, you know, in Istanbul.
We had that in Manhattan with Occupy Wall Street.
Right,
I mean, the
know,
police came in and emptied all our people out.
So, you know, I think there are rights and there are wrongs here, but they don't warrant foreign intervention. And, you know, this is one of the issues that we're coping with even to this day, which is, you know, the demonization of one group of people and treating them differently because of their religion and their background, particularly here in New York City, where Muslims, you know, feel that they've been targeted unfairly by the New York City police and have filed suit. Deepa Kumar is on the phone with us from Rutgers University. Deepa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Can you speak up just a little bit?
Sure. Can you hear me now?
That's better, yeah. I'm sorry, we've had some problems with phone calls and whatnot, back and forth, dates and everything else that could go wrong, did go wrong, but you're here but you're here with us. Tell us a little bit about this lawsuit. I have with me a young Muslim student from Kazakhstan who's here, and, you know, I think she's trying to still understand what's happening to Muslim people here in New York City and the targeting of Muslims, you know, unfairly. So what has been your research and experience on this?
Right. Basically, in 2011 and 2012, we heard, because of the investigative journalism of the Associated Press, we got to know that the NYPD, in fact, had systematically infiltrated mosques, Muslim bookstores, student groups on campuses right across the Northeast, right? This is not just in New Jersey, but even in Connecticut, as well as in New York City and New York State and so on. And they were attempting to create something called the Human Mapping Program, where they could identify all of the people, where they go, how they shop, and so forth. And this is, of course, you know, even at the time that it was brought to public attention, it was seen as being racial profiling. It was religious profiling. And it's based on the belief that because people are Muslim, they're automatically suspicious and therefore should be targeted in this way. And the recent case that has been brought, the lawsuit that has been brought by the ACLU and the New York branch of the ACLU is attempting to shut it down, because even though this expose happened, you know, good 2 years ago, nothing has been done to shut it down. And I think the timing is really important given the recent NSA leaks, which show that it's not just Muslims who have been targeted through surveillance, but, you know, the general American public, and particularly, you know, if there's time, I'll talk about liberal organizations and social movement activists.
You know, we really don't know. We heard these reports about the Tea Party being targeted by the IRS. But if you read those stories closely and you went towards the end of the stories, you realize that there were other organizations, not Tea Party organizations, that came under, you know, the scrutiny, you know, of the IRS, were being harassed and get treated the same way. Many of them were progressive organizations.
Well, but that's another story, Danny, because I don't think any of those organizations, including our progressive organization, should get tax breaks. I mean, if you're going to do charity, if you're going to, you know, work for your cause, go do it. That's America. It's a free country. But why should the rest of the taxpayers subsidize you, no matter what your politics are?
I mean, I want to bring it back, though, to the NSA prison program and the, you know, the phone information and so forth, the NSA leaks that Edward Snowden put out. I think in this context, the vast majority of Americans have said, you know, this is wrong. This is a violation of our privacy and so forth. But it's important, I think, to point out, and there was a really good story in the Guardian newspaper about how over the last 3 to 4 years, particularly since 2008, the security establishment has actually put out a number of reports which suggest that they see economic crisis, climate change, energy shocks as actually vitalizing social movements. And so they have used surveillance against environmental groups, against the Occupy Wall Street movement, and so on. And it's really, it's not just surveillance, actually. Just last month, the U.S. military altered some of its laws, and it now allows for the Pentagon to intervene domestically when there is a supposed emergency or a civil disturbance. So, you know, we're inching towards a national security state that is attempting to crack down not just on Muslims, which is very important, but on dissent in general.
And it's also a corporate thing. I mean, they're going after animal rights people and agricultural activists. It's not just political. It's people that want good, clean food, like anything that's hurting corporate profits. They've got
the anti-Monsanto movement isn't left or right particularly, but, you know, it's also being targeted this way.
And the definition of fascism is government and corporate power combined, and that's what we're looking at. That's what started out against the Muslims. That was very unfair, but now it's everybody.
You know, it's the
That's right. I mean, that's why I think, you know, the labor slogan, an injury to one is an injury to all, is really so right, because the entire legal system has been revamped since 9/11, but certainly before that, with all sorts of, you know, it's not just surveillance, it's preemptive prosecution, it's, you know, sending agents provocateurs to get people to do things and so forth and then arrest them. All sorts of ways the legal system has been revamped, but it's been done fundamentally by projecting this image of this evil Islamic terrorist, this threat that looms everywhere, against which we should, you know, voluntarily give up our civil liberties
but
to be safe, apparently.
Doesn't that play to racial stereotyping also? In other words,
absolutely.
All of these Muslims are alike. Okay, they're out to get us, basically, and largely because of their religious, you know, approach. We know had this with the so-called Ground Zero mosque controversy here in New York, where, you know, it was a talk about hate speech. I mean, you couldn't believe some of the, you know, kind of vicious attacks that were being made on all people of the Islamic faith.
But, you know, we have to get a context, because as an old timer, I grew up with the Red Scare, you know, and I was like so frightened to even have a pamphlet somebody gave me from the Communist Party. I threw it down the incinerator as a child. I was so afraid. And that's what we're having now. Instead of the Red Scare, we're having the Terror Scare. And this is the same forces. We have to look at the context. It's been happening over and over again in America. This is
that's
the new
exactly
way.
Exactly right. And that's exactly right. This is a manufactured crisis. If you look at the research, for instance, of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security, they've done some of the most sort of comprehensive studies on the supposed threats that the Muslim American community poses. And what they found is in 10 years after 9/11, right, they studied from 9/11, from 2001 to 2011, during that time period, there have been 150,000 murders in the United States,
right,
of which Muslim Americans are responsible for 33, less than 1%, right? And yet there is this spectacle that gets generated in the same way as you might remember, you know, the way in which duck and cover used to happen. Right. People would be asked to, children would be asked to duck underneath their desks to protect themselves from a nuclear attack. And, of course, that's not to really protect you. It's to keep you scared so that, you know, the U.S. government can have carte blanche to do whatever it wants on the global stage as well as domestically. And that's what's happening today with the war on terror and the Muslim enemy that has, you know, become the convenient face of these policies.
Well, fear is a great drug. I mean, it's a fantastic narcotic. It freezes people in place so that, you know, a corporatocracy can institute anything whatsoever. And, well, it's to keep you all safe. You're terrified now, right?
Yeah, but just think of this chemical plant that blew up in Texas and killed several hundred people. I mean,
and then there were that followed that.
Right, and just think of all the deaths from pollution or chemicals or, you know, radiation from corporate. Nobody's scared of that. It's like this is a deliberate manipulation by
And it's so easy to, in a sense, change the story, the Snowden story, Deep. I love your comment on that. I mean, here I have a very close former associate work with me on the South African Now television series, and she was saying, you know, I don't know about this Snowden character. I think he working for the Chinese? He must be working for the Chinese because he moved to Hong Kong. Therefore, you know, 1 + 2 = 7. You know, therefore, it's conclusive. And of course, Snowden has totally denied this, and there's no evidence for it. But nevertheless, people believe it because it sounds plausible.
He didn't graduate high school, so the man must be a loser. And
he likes Chinese food.
But you know what's frightening? Because
I mean, this is a smear campaign, right? What do you do when you have information that is so damning about the violation of privacy, the violation of the Constitution? Is you try to kill the messenger using stupid things like he didn't finish high school. Well, if he didn't finish high school, why would he have been hired to work for the NSA? You know what I mean? And being paid $250,000 and
because
so on.
But you know,
it's nonsense.
I feel a little concerned because there are so many people that are willing to give the government a free ride on this. I'm surprised.
Because
I think we've lost our sense of what it is to be a citizen.
No. You just don't read Thomas Friedman enough, Alice. we need a balance between freedom and security, and we have to balance, you know, our needs in this respect and be willing to give up our personal freedoms if it's in the interests of trying to stop another 9/11. That's what they were writing.
That's not true, Deepa. That's not true. She's right.
It is absolutely not true.
It's a lie.
I mean, even
it's not true,
figures.
But it's in the New York Times, Deepa.
But see, here's the thing. Even establishment figures like Senators Ron Wyden and Mark Udall, you know, when Robert Mueller was talking to, senators, the FBI director, and arguing, you know, so many terror plots have been foiled and so on, they debunked that and they said there's no evidence for that. And that's true, in fact, because if you look at this book, it's by an investigative reporter by the name of Trevor Aronson. It's called Terror Factory. And what he shows is that a number of these so-called foiled terror plots were actually instigated by the FBI. No. They send, you know, agent provocateurs into communities where they prey on the vulnerable, incite them to committing some sort of act, give them, you know, very often even give them the tools to do that. And when they do, aha, there's suddenly a TV crew and everybody there to say yet another terror plot that's been foiled. You know, this is an elaborate charade that we're being asked to give our consent to.
But, it seems to play well, as they say, in Peoria. I mean, it seems to be a part of a playbook of tactics that are used again and again to divide people on the one hand, to defame people on the other, to target people who we have perhaps a suspicion of in one way or another.
Used all over the world. I mean, when enough people are cynical toward the government, hate the government, or just don't believe it anymore, you point to those, on the outside. They're trying to get you. And who else but the government can do anything about it?
This was like the Red Scare in the 50s.
The Red Scare and, it's... Well, you know, it's the Jews. And,
so then we need programs like this to get the information out.
And VIPA and guests like you to actually help us articulate clearly and back up, you know, our often perhaps poorly informed attitudes with real information. We really appreciate it. What is your latest book that we can tell folks about?
Well, the book is called Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire, and it's exactly what we've been talking about, which is the idea that this menacing Muslim enemy has been created literally out of ether to justify the aims of U.S. imperialism both abroad as well as domestically. And the next book that I'm actually working on is about terrorism and the language of terrorism and how it's been manipulated, again, to keep people scared.
Well, so. Deepa Kumar, thank you so much for joining us. This has been an extremely fascinating program. We've gone from Northern Ireland to New York City, now to the reaches of New Jersey, Rutgers University. For you to join us, I appreciate it. I'd like you to come back on sometime and get into
Absolutely.
More detail about some of these issues that you're so articulate about. This is News Dissector Radio with Danny Schechter, your News Dissector, Polar Levine in the house, providing the music that really gives us a soulful connection another way of understanding the world.
And a provocative commentary as well.
Needless to say. And I just want to tell you, I'm going to be going away for a few weeks to Africa, so I may not be here, but we will be rebroadcasting some of our programs. You can reach me at dissector@mediachannel.org. Please visit my daily blog, newsdissector.net, and themediachannel.org, which is our website that says, as the media watches the world, we watch the media. So thank you for being with us on PRN FM. We're going to be kicking it into a new song to leave you with, and then we're on our way. Thank you so much for listening.